Okay, well, thanks for.
Okay, how's that? Oh, I see.
All right. Well, I want to thank the advisor for having me speak. I did my undergrad here at U of T, so it's nice to be able to come back and still be wanted after no longer paying dues to the university. anyways, so my talk today is on churn numbers and their application to Hilbert modular varieties. So if you're sort of well-versed in Turing classes, and you might find the first half of this lecture quite dull, but hopefully the second half will be more illuminating. And if you aren't familiar with Turing classes, then hopefully my brief introduction will suffice to be able to understand the application to Hilbert modular varieties. Okay, so to begin with sort of the functorial definition for characteristic classes, let's fix some topological group G, then one can define this contravariant functor from the category of topological spaces to sets that sends X to its set of isomorphism classes of G bundles, and a map between topological spaces gets sent to the corresponding pullback map. So then, sort of the definition for characteristic classes is built upon this. We say that a characteristic class is any natural transformation of this functor with a fixed cohomology functor. So I've listed sort of more common examples down below. If we need classes for real bundles, Euler class for oriented real bundles, Turing classes for complex bundles, and Pontryagin classes. So again, obviously from my talk, I'm going to be focused on Turing classes. Now, here's sort of these cohomological topological definitions that require an excessive amount of sort of unnecessary notation and definitions that will be used only for this particular definition and not again in the talk. So I'm going to sort of skip these particular definition and go straight to the sort of algebraic approach of defining Turing classes, and then I will remark about how these sort of topological approach can be reconciled with the algebraic approach. So let's recall for a smooth quasi-projective variety X over some algebraically closed field K, we have the Chow ring, which is just a graded ring, each sort of level corresponding to irreducible subvarieties of some fixed codimension modulo rational equivalence, and we have intersection being the multiplication operation on this ring. Then if we fix a locally free sheaf, denoted E here, then there one can construct a canonical projective bundle lying over X from the data of E. Now, to say that locally, if we take some open affine set for X, say spectrum of A, and E splits over this open set, then the corresponding pre-image in the projective bundle will just look like a projective R space of A. So in particular, each of these open sets sort of has the Sayre's twisted sheaf line metal lying over top of it, and those sheaves glue together to give a global line bundle over this canonically defined projective space. So we have a line bundle lying over a projective bundle lying over our original variety X. And in particular, this line bundle induces cycle zeta, which is very useful in expressing the Chow ring of the projective bundle. In particular, the powers of zeta up to R minus 1 generate it as a free graded module respect to the Chow ring of X. So in particular, zeta to the R satisfies a unique monomial whose coefficients can be viewed as sort of elements inside of the Chow ring of X. And these particular coefficients are what we're going to define as the Turing classes induced from the sheaf E. So as promised, we should sort of reconcile this with this cohomological notions of characteristic classes I mentioned on the first slide. So note that when K is the complex numbers and X is a projective variety, then sort of we can use Poincaré duality to identify the Chow ring of X with the sort of cohomological ring with usual cup product, and sort of these two notions agree in this case. So throughout the talk, I'll sort of be going back and forth between cohomological definition and sort of this Chow ring definition. Okay, so just a couple of examples of uses for Turing classes. In order to sort of express these relationships compactly, one usually defines this Turing polynomial, which is just a formal polynomial with coefficients as Turing classes. And then we have some examples of relationships. So the direct sum of two sheaves has a Turing polynomial, which is a product of the Turing polynomials of the sheaves. And actually, more generally, if you fit inside of a short exact sequence, the analogous statement holds for the middle sheaf in terms of the two outer sheaves. Okay, so trivial bundles, we have a trivial Turing polynomial. There's a relationship between the Turing polynomial of a dual bundle. If you have a line bundle arising from a divisor, then somehow this is encoded within the non-trivial Turing class of the line bundle. And there's also the splitting principle, which is significantly more complicated to write down, but let's just say that it allows you to sort of deduce a number of additional relationships similar to this top one up here by basically reducing certain relationships to the case when your sheaf is a product of line bundles. And in particular, you get relationships between, say, the tensor product of two sheaves and the wedge product of a sheaf with itself. Okay, and at the bottom of here, I've listed a couple of examples for full Turing polynomials for various common spaces to be studied. So most often we're going to be interested in Turing classes for a tangent bundle sheaf. So if I only denote the underlying manifold and not the actual sheaf itself, then just assume that I mean the tangent bundle. So the Turing polynomial for affine space is trivial. Obvious. This is sort of obvious, just from sort of the remark that a trivial bundle of any dimension is as a trivial Turing polynomial. Of course, the Chow ring of a projective space is generated by a divisor of a hyperplane. So somehow we have this binomial expansion. Sort of relationships will give us the exact coefficient on each of the Turing classes, and there's sort of an analogous formula for complete intersections of hypersurfaces can be derived from sort of the formula for projective space, and then also some of these relationships discussed above. Okay, so what uses do Turing classes have? One thing I didn't mention, but is somehow intrinsically obvious, is that for starters, isomorphic bundles need to have the same Turing classes, so they provide an immediate, can immediately tell you whether or not two bundles are not isomorphic. I'm just gonna skip some of that. Oh, okay, so Turing classes provide obstructions to embeddings. Using sort of the remark about how Turing polynomials need to factor for if the corresponding bundles decompose. But the number one use that we're going to be using for this talk is Turing numbers. So what are Turing numbers? Well, you can consider from the cohomological point of view, if you have a compact complex manifold, you can consider cohomology elements of top degree that arise from cup products of Turing classes. And once you have these elements, then you can consider, say, evaluating on the fundamental class or thinking in terms of Durham cohomology. This would be like integrating over your manifold. And this would give you integer values, and these values are called Turing numbers. Also there you can see the corresponding definition in terms of Chow ring. Okay, Turing numbers are actually surprisingly useful and contain a high amount of various arithmetic and geometric data encoded within them. So various genera can be expressed in terms of Chern numbers. We have the generalization of Riemann-Roch formula can be expressed in terms of Chern numbers and sort of in terms of the similar construction of Chern numbers and taking products of Chern classes for various sheaves and then evaluating them on the fundamental class. Intersection numbers of divisors are often encoded. So for example, this Chern number corresponding to n copies of the lowest Chern class for the tangent bundle gives you up to a sine, the self-intersection number of the canonical divisor. And other sort of cohomological data, again, the top degree Chern class gives you a Chern number that is the Euler number, the alternating sum of Betti numbers for a singular cohomology. Okay, so now that we're all sort of experts on Chern classes and Chern numbers, I guess I should make this talk sort of relevant to the conference's theme and discuss the applications to Hilbert modular varieties. So, as discussed in the previous two talks, we'll just pick some totally real field F of degree N, Hilbert modular group G, and gamma will be some modular group either full or a torsion-free arithmetic subgroup. Y sub gamma will be our N copies of the upper half plane mod gamma. The hat denotes sort of the Baylor-Borel compactification. And we can resolve this sort of, especially well-known in two-dimensional case, the resolution will be noted by Z sub gamma. So at the bottom of this slide here, I just briefly mentioned the resolution process, but I know that, well, it's been mentioned before, and there's a talk entitled Toroidal Compactification, so one would assume that that talk will go into more detail, so I'll just leave that to the experts. But what I'm interested in is the following. So oftentimes it might come up that you're interested in what sort of shared properties or how can one classify these Z sub gamma as we perhaps fix the field and let gamma vary, or conversely if we fix gamma as some sort of condition as in being a certain congruent subgroup and we let F vary, we want to know sort of how well we can classify them. Again, for the N equals 2 case, sort of a lot of work has been done because this theory of minimal models is so rich in the two-dimensional case. So I've listed a couple of explicit examples for minimal models for these spaces. But one sort of major result is the following, due to Hirzebruch and Zaire. So if we let F be a real quadratic field with just fundamental discriminant D, and we require that gamma be the full modular group, then we're able to actually fit all of these spaces into the Enrique Codera rough classification of compact complex surfaces, which is essentially the understanding of the cohomology groups for their for these sheaves of I forms. Okay, so one notes that all these surfaces in general have to be regular and simply connected. Regular just means that one of these dimensions is always zero, but it's not particularly relevant. And in particular, this means that the Codera dimension completely determines the type of these spaces. So if the Codera dimension is negative 1 or negative infinity, depending upon what you want to call it, and it's a rational surface, otherwise the dimension is 0, then you have a blown up K3. If the dimension is 1, you have a blown up honestly elliptic. And of course, if the dimension is 2, then you have a space of general type. So well, if you're familiar with Codera dimension, you know that sort of Chern numbers play a very large role in determining these values, and hence in determining sort of the classification of these surfaces. So in particular, one example is in the case when D is a prime congruent with 1 mod 4, the arithmetic genus actually completely determines the Codera dimension, and via Noether's formula down at the bottom here, you can express the arithmetic genus in terms of these Chern values. So this is sort of a well-known result before the complete classification. Okay, so more generally, to sort of classify all all such surfaces of this type. Basically, the approach was to find a particular D such that for all true numbers, or for all fields with discriminant larger than this, with fundamental discriminant larger than this D, somehow the true numbers would necessarily have to be so large that these surfaces would have to be of general type. And then after sort of this bound has been found, all it requires is to sort of calculate these churn numbers and some other data for these finite number of cases below that. So this is actually not too hard to do from a computational point of view, because the churn numbers can be expressed in terms of other sort of well-known arithmetic geometric data that I've listed here, these formulas for these particular spaces. We see Dedekind's data values. These AI are just basically counting up the number of quotient singularities. And then this L0 negative is counting up curves arising within some sort of rising in the resolution of cusps. And at the bottom of this page, I've just listed the classification. In particular, as mentioned, all but a finite number are of general type, which is expected because somehow being general is, well, in general, what you would expect. So, okay, well, what about a three-dimensional case, or even just any case higher than two? Again, because sort of the theory of minimal models is much sort of not quite as rich as in a two-dimensional case, somehow much less work has been done for classifying these structures. Note that Ehlers, we do have a method for constructing these Z sub gamma, which was just a generalization of Herz's group by Ehlers. But if you're familiar with that decomposition, somehow the fact that the totally positive units are cyclic is used very judiciously within the within the construction. And obviously, for higher dimensions, this isn't true in general. So somehow the construction isn't quite as canonical, and you have to sort of take it, you have to sort of use some handwork in a case-by-case scenario. But in the early 80s, Thomas and Vasquez sort of tried their hand at a first sort of approximation of getting some sort of equivalence relationship between these spaces, and they wanted to classify these Z sub gamma up to complex cobordism, which is a generalization of the usual notion of cobordism. And much like the usual notion of cobordism, which says that a manifold is completely, its equivalence class is completely determined by its Stiefel-Whitney numbers, complex cobordism, these values are completely determined by their churn numbers. So essentially, Thomas and Vasquez's work reduced to deriving formulas for the churn numbers for these complex dimensional spaces. So to conclude with sort of a survey of how they went about doing this, note, as sort of I mentioned earlier, again, these true numbers all reflect interesting geometric invariants. Of course, we have self-intersection of the canonical bundle and the Euler number appearing, and then we also have arithmetic genus appearing as a churn number. Now, so the arithmetic genera is actually a birational invariant in this case, and so it is independent of the resolution chosen for your Y sub gamma. So it's actually very easily calculated straight from this theorem listed at the bottom of the page, because we're working over a cubic field. So of course, there's always going to be a unit of norm negative 1, namely negative 1 itself. So it was calculating the arithmetic genera, and hence the corresponding churn number is very simple in this case. Just again, in terms of counting up sort of the number of quotient singularities, and then also these Dedekind zeta values. Okay, but the other two invariants are significantly more delicate and depend on the actual resolution chosen. So what Thomas and Vasquez did was they showed that you could consider each cusp resolution individually and sort of calculate the corresponding invariant on a local neighborhood and then use this data to use this local data to calculate the global invariant. And this is actually good from a sort of algorithmic perspective because calculating these local values are actually quite easy, and the data to do so just arises naturally within the resolution process. In fact, I believe this E sub I, or the local Euler numbers, are just arise from like counting up the number of three simplices that arise within the within some part of the resolution process, and then similar for the local sort of intersection values. Again, it's just counting up some data that is very easy to do from a finite algorithm. So the I'll just conclude by stating sort of their theorem. Again, gamma subgroup modular type, totally real cubic field F, and Z sub gamma non-singular Hilbert modular variety with resolutions we cut fixed. Then we have these expressions for the two invariants as mentioned, and note that sort of their methodology for proof was sort of exactly as I mentioned. Basically, one takes a neighborhood around each sort of singularity, the cusps and also the quotients, and then one has one large neighborhood to sort of glue everything together, much like sort of similar things go on in the two-dimensional case. And then one calculates sort of a local data, and then it has to be shown that sort of the sum of all this local data can be glued together to give you the global invariant. And I mean, just looking at the formula, you can tell exactly what the contribution of each sort of neighborhood is. Namely, if you have a neighborhood, these AIs are just the contributions of the neighborhoods for the quotient singularities of some given type. And then the K3 and the E are just the sum of the contributions for all the cuspidal neighborhoods. And then this zeta value is just the contribution of sort of the main body of the surface, or sorry, the threefold. So let me just conclude by noting that sort of again, this paper was in the early 80s, and sort of since that time, there's been a rather boom in the theory of minimal models for three-dimensional complex manifolds, due mostly to the Fields work of Mori. Fields Medal winning work of Mori. So I sort of wanted to consider whether or not sort of these values, I mean, sort of these equations give explicit ways to calculate Chern numbers. And I thought it was, you know, the interesting question is whether or not people have, like, sort of used these equations to map out the various topological geography of spaces, of these Z sub gamma spaces, and see if there was sort of a similar result to, say, the two-dimensional case, where one could postulate that, say, for all but a finite number of totally real cubic fields, any resolution with respect to the full modular group is necessarily necessarily admits a minimal model of general type. But my brief search through the literature unfortunately did not return fruitful with that, so certainly, I don't know if it has been done or not, but it's certainly a question as to whether one could perhaps bootstrap the argument from the two-dimensional case up to the three-dimensional case or not, but something to consider. So that's the conclusion of my talk. Here's some references if you're interested, and these notes will be online.